Thanks, Jane. It's a pleasure to speak here today in my hometown. Neil has spoken a bit about some of the details of the regulatory reform process currently underway in Australia and globally, and my aim today is to provide some of the broader implications of the reform. But before doing so, there's an important point to make, which I hope the main point I'll try and make today, is that the changes we all see the banking and financial system undergoing at the moment are not purely the result of regulatory changes. Rather, there are a number of forces all pushing in the same direction. So some of the changes we see going on are self-imposed as financial institutions themselves look at the lessons over recent years and seek to increase their own resiliency to future developments. Some are being imposed by the market in terms of the availability of both the quantity and price of particular channels of financing, and others reflect pressures from agencies such as the rating agencies. Currently, all of those forces are generally aligned in changing the structure of the financial system in the same direction, although they may vary in terms of degree. So in that sense, the impact of regulation is not as large as it appears on the surface and is certainly not as large as some would have you believe. Rather, regulation is, in many cases, serving to reinforce the other forces at work. But the regulatory changes are going to be binding when these forces are no longer all pushing in the same direction. So the experience over many years, and particularly over the earlier part of this century, is that some of these forces are certain to wane when the credit cycle is in full upswing. In the good times, self-discipline can falter under the weight of competitive pressures, as can market discipline. So hopefully in those circumstances, the regulatory framework will continue to impart the necessary restraint. So as I said, one of the main points I want to make today is that regulation at the moment is mostly serving to reinforce what is being imposed by the banks and financial institutions themselves, as well as the market. When it's going to matter is when we're on the other side of the cycle. So today I'm going to focus on the Basel III reforms, as we're here to talk about, but there are a number of other reforms, such as those around central clearing and OTC derivatives, which may sound a bit arcane to some of you, but they are going to have a significant impact on the way many of you will do business, but I'll leave them for another time. So as Neil mentioned, the Basel III measures will strengthen the requirements for financial institutions, liquidity and capital, and it's the impact of those reforms on financial markets and on funding costs that I'll talk about today. So in thinking about this issue, it is important to remember that the intent of the regulatory reforms is to alter the incentive financial institutions and thereby bring about changes in behaviour. The prices of various financial products will change from their pre-crisis levels. This is not an unintended consequence. It is an intended consequence. Personally, I think the phrase unintended consequences is one which is grossly overused. So let me give a quick summary of the Basel liquidity reforms. Neil gave you a bit of an indication of this, but basically the 40 or so largest deposit-taking intermediaries in Australia are going to be required to hold high-quality liquid assets in quantities good enough to withstand a 30-day stress test. This liquidity coverage ratio, or LCR, is, as Neil said, a tougher metric than that used in the past, both in terms of the severity and length of the stress period, as well as the criteria for what qualifies an asset as liquid. So on the latter, the test of whether an asset is liquid and of high quality is whether the asset would be able to maintain its value during periods of stress. The financial crisis revealed that the universe of such assets which can maintain their value in a period of stress was a lot smaller than banks, and indeed some of their regulators, had previously assumed. In particular, the liquidity-generating capacity of private sector debt deteriorated significantly during periods of market stress, even where such debt had been highly rated by the rating agencies. This was the case most obviously for securitised assets, such as asset-backed commercial paper, residential mortgage-backed securities, as well as unsecured paper. For many of these assets, the only source of liquidity was that provided by the central bank. This was true in Australia as well as globally. So in recognition of this, the intent of regulatory reform is to require financial institutions to hold more of their liquidity in debt securities issued by sovereigns, subject to the requirement that these sovereigns themselves are highly rated and their securities are liquid, which is obviously not something which is true in every sovereign at the moment. This would be expected to widen the spreads between the yields on high-quality sovereigns and the yields on private debt securities. But to a large extent, this repricing occurred globally during the financial crisis, as the market itself reached the same conclusion as to what constituted a liquid asset. That is, the fact that a lot of private sector debt self-evidently wasn't that liquid prompted financial market participants themselves to adjust liquidity risk premia they require on this debt, quite independently of any direction from regulators. So in the Australian market, you can see a reassessment of risk and changes in investor preferences for such risk has been important in driving the spread between Commonwealth Government securities, CGS, and yields on highly rated private debt securities. So here we go. Let me try and explain this one. This is the spreads of various financial instruments, or bonds mostly, relative to the swap rate. So the red line, which for CGS shows that CGS has a lower yield than swap. The blue line is for an unsecured bank bond. The yellow line is for covered bonds, which have just been issued since the beginning or late last year. And the light blue line is for mortgage-backed securities. So you can see, particularly in 2008, the massive repricing of mortgage-backed securities relative to swap. And you can see on the red line that CGS has traded at a significant premium to swap throughout, and that premium has got wider. But it's unlikely that any regulatory initiatives, and certainly not those related to Basel III liquidity requirements, have been behind the demand for CGS we have seen in recent years. Indeed, and you might have read this in the paper this morning as a response to an FOI request on us, the major source of demand for CGS has come from foreign investors, including central banks, sovereign wealth funds and pension funds, attracted by the strength of the Australian economy and the sovereign's credit standing. Non-residents now hold more than 75% or 3/4 of outstanding government debt on issue. So if you look at the amount of government debt on issue in Australia by the Commonwealth, more than 3/4 of that is held offshore. In contrast, and that's the line down the bottom there, the banks hold very little Commonwealth government securities. So it's very hard looking at that graph to make the claim that it's the liquidity standards which have driven the repricing of CGS relative to other assets. It's clearly coming from other sources. Within the Australian market, the only assets deemed to meet the Basel standard for liquidity are CGS, semi-government securities, so those issued by institutions such as SEFA, cash and the accounts that the banks hold with us at the Reserve Bank. So as is pretty well known, the supply of CGS and semis in Australia will be insufficient for the Australian bank's liquidity requirements. And for that reason, the Reserve Bank has announced it will establish a committed liquidity facility. So let me try and explain what that is. So the banks pay on the payment of a 15 basis point fee, Australian banks will be able to obtain a commitment from us at the Reserve Bank to provide liquidity against a broad range of assets under repurchased agreements. Eligible assets include a range of highly rated debts, private debt securities, including a bank's own self-securitised mortgages. The Reserve Bank's commitments to the private banks is to provide liquidity against these assets, and that will be recognised by APRA in terms of their compliance with the LCR. As I've said on a few times before, this arrangement is to a large extent just a formalisation of the pre-existing liquidity arrangements in Australia and is very much consistent with the sort of fundamental principles of central banking. The imposition of that 15 basis point fee ensures that the intent of the Basel standard will be met. By charging the banks for the liquidity insurance that we are providing. The appropriate incentive is established for the banks to manage their liquidity risk. At the same time, the design of this facility will contain the impact of regulatory-induced demand for liquid assets in an environment where so few assets outside the banking system existed. For instance, if you look at this, it would be very hard for the banks to go out and try and buy any more CGS, particularly as nearly all of it is held offshore. It just isn't there. So, and one of the reasons why we set the fee at the level we did is to make sure that the banks don't turn around and decide that the way they want to meet their liquidity requirements is just by piling up balances with us, which would make our balance sheet very large and we'd have to go out and work out what assets we wanted to buy, which is not necessarily a situation we want to be in. Let me turn to another repricing which has occurred and talk about whether it's as a result of regulation or other forces. So within the kangaroo market, which is Australian dollar bonds issued by offshore entities such as the World Bank or or a number of sort of supranational institutions in Europe. There's also been a large repricing of those instruments. When APRA was making its initial assessment of what securities would qualify as liquid assets, there was concern expressed about the consequences for that kangaroo market if that debt wasn't considered to be level one assets. Now, as it turns out, APRA, in conjunction with us, decided that that debt wasn't going to be considered as level one assets. But banks can still bring those debt instruments to us and on the payment of the fee, swap them for liquidity. So that's the only difference between kangaroo bonds and CGS, is that you have to pay a 15 basis point fee. But in fact, the repricing of those instruments has been considerably larger. That repricing has come about not because of the Basel liquidity standards, but due to altered perceptions of their credit of the creditworthiness of these institutions by rating agencies and market participants. More generally, great store is often placed in terms of whether an asset is eligible for repo with the central bank or not. But reliance on repo eligibility doesn't strike me as a particularly strong cornerstone of a good issuance program. In recent months, we have seen a number of non-repo eligible kangaroo issuers come to the Australian market, including some first-time issuers. So that seems to me another indication that there are much more important elements that determine investor demand than whether an asset is repo eligible or not. So in addition to the issue of which securities can be held as liquid assets, the other dimension of liquidity regulation is how many of these assets need to be held. In that regard, the Basel the LCR framework makes certain assumptions about the likely calls on a liquidity that a bank would experience during this 30-day stress period. One assumption, based on the experience of the past 5 years, is that any liquidity commitment that a bank gives to other financial institutions, including things such as structured investment vehicles, which were the vehicles which sat behind a lot of mortgage-backed securities, those liquidity commitments are almost certainly going to be called in full during a stress scenario. That has significantly lessened the incentives for structures such as those designed to exploit regulatory arbitrage. Again, though, the decline in the number of those structures can hardly be attributed to regulatory change. Their viability was undermined when investors and rating agencies also came to the view that the quality of such instruments was largely tied to the quality of the supporting bank. So that's seen a decline in the number of mortgage warehouses. So what mortgage warehouses where particularly a non-bank places its mortgages before it puts it into one of these mortgage-backed securities and sells them into the market. But the main reason those mortgage warehouses have declined is because the price of providing liquidity that has been significantly increased to take account of the fact that they are a much greater liquidity risk. Most of the non-bank mortgage providers don't really have a balance sheet to warehouse their mortgages on, so we've seen a marked decline in their number and market share over the past 5 years. So in terms of the support that a bank provides to its internal business units, so if you think about the way a bank treasury raises money and then provides the funds to its lending arms, the changes to the regulatory framework will alter how banks price liquidity and capital usage across the different components of their business. By their nature, these internal prices are rarely transparent to outside observers, but the incentives created by such prices can have significant implications for financial markets. At the moment, there's a lot of repricing across all product lines going on, as you're no doubt aware. One obvious example is in the effect on pricing of undrawn lines of credit, so basically overdraft facilities, where the increase in the pricing resulted from the increased liquidity cost of providing an overdraft facility has seen a marked reduction in their use. Calls on a bank's liquidity will also arise when they are unable to roll over or maintain their existing funding. Assumptions regarding the likelihood of this are based on the regulator's views about what forms of funding are more stable than others. So going forward, these runoff assumptions should be expected to influence the funding strategies adopted by banks. For instance, issuing a piece of unsecured paper with less than 30 days to maturity is not going to be a particularly viable funding option for banks anymore, because that gets very heavily penalised under the liquidity standard. But at the same time, as we've seen a much reduced incentive for banks to provide those sort of short-term liquidity, those short-term instruments, on the other side, the demand for liquidity from institutions such as insurance companies or pension funds is increasing, again, in part because of regulatory pressure. So at the moment we're seeing a decrease in the supply of these short-term liquidity assets and an increase in demand for liquidity. And normally in economics, when there's an increase in a decrease in supply and an increase in demand, the price changes. And in this case, the price of liquidity you'd expect to rise to clear the market. My concern at the moment is it's not clear that the demand and the supply curve are actually going to intersect at any sort of reasonable price. That is, it's not clear there is actually any price which is going to clear that market at the moment. How this is resolved is not entirely clear, but if you end up pushing the supply of liquidity outside the regulated financial system, that's not necessarily something that we'd be wanting to see. In any case, it's quite probable that you'll start to see new funding instruments emerge. In some jurisdictions, in some other countries at the moment, you're seeing 31-day instruments. So Neil mentioned this test is a 30-day stress scenario, so banks are starting to issue 31-day instruments. Now, one thing as regulators we're going to have to keep an eye on, that this doesn't create a new stress point at 31 days as funding piles up at that maturity. One product where we are yet to see the effect of new liquidity regulation on pricing is at-call deposits. So if you think about your online at-call account, you may have noticed it gives you a pretty decent interest rate at the moment. Relative to other types of products, these products are very expensive from a liquidity point of view, from the banks supplying them. But they still are offering interest rates that are a large spread above the cash rate. As banks start to focus on the full liquidity costs of such products, I would expect to see these rates decline. It's not necessarily good for you if you've got a whole lot of money in one of those online at-call accounts, but anyway. Indeed, it would be surprising if this repricing doesn't occur fairly soon, given, as Neil said, the liquidity regulations take effect at the beginning of 2015. But our liaison with the bank suggests that these deposits are particularly sensitive to changes in pricing. That is, if a bank starts to reduce its price, it suddenly finds, particularly most of these are internet accounts, people are very adept at moving it very quickly to the other bank which hasn't reduced its price. So that's sort of holding back this sort of repricing. But if an institution has a large reliance on this sort of funding, it won't be able to change that reliance overnight on the 31st of December 2014. So just like supertankers, funding structures take a long time to change direction, and that change, of course, of funding needs to be occurring right now. So on the subject of funding, let me turn to how that's changed for the Australian banks over the past few years. As we said on a number of occasions, it's fairly obvious in this graph. This just shows the way that the Australian banking system funds itself in terms of the different sorts of products. And you can see the most marked changes there, the increase in share of funding coming from deposits and the decrease in share of funding coming from short-term debt. So there's clearly been a shift towards deposit funding. This shift has been a deliberate strategy on the part of banks and has been brought about by significant changes to their pricing. So the interest rates, as you're probably all aware, offered on term deposits are now priced well above the rates at which banks issue instruments of similar maturity. So what I've got here is the price of a term deposit, the sort of special you get when you see in the window of the bank, and I've also got the price of a bank bill of the same sort of maturity. And you can see that deposits used to pay a lot less than a bank bill, now they pay a hell of a lot more. So given the forthcoming liquidity regulations, a shift towards deposits certainly makes sense. The Basel III framework views deposits as much more stable and has lower runoff assumptions. However, as with the relative price of liquid assets, one can't explain all of the sort of movement in deposit pricing you see here in terms of just the liquidity regulations. The intensity of the competition and the rates paid on some of these deposits far exceed the implied regulatory incentive that Neil was talking about earlier. So why then are banks willing to pay such high rates for this type of funding? To a large extent, the impetus has come from an internal reassessment of funding resiliency and has come from the broader market, where a bank's ability to attract deposits has received greater attention since the financial crisis. Quite possibly, some of the focus on deposit-to-loan ratios and similar metrics that are used to assess a bank's sort of viability are misplaced. But regardless, while term deposits appear to be a very expensive source of funding, banks presumably believe the alternatives would be even more expensive for their overall cost of funds. Nevertheless, the effects of changes in the funding competition, in the funding composition on the total change in funding costs over the past five years has been fairly marginal. The increase in the cost of funding for banks and ultimately their customers has been driven considerably more by a fundamental reassessment within financial markets of the risks associated with credit and liquidity exposures. The regulatory effort towards promoting more stable sources of debt funding is driven by a desire to foster financial system stability. As has been noted before, and as is apparent from the intense competition for deposits, changes in this direction have also been pursued by the banks on their own initiative. To the extent that regulations push banks to adopt the funding structure that market discipline would not otherwise make them do, I think that effect has been very small, and the overall effect on funding costs is smaller still. Moreover, as Neil said earlier, and as we certainly agree, any costs of this magnitude are well worth paying for a more stable financial system. In terms of thinking about the broader macro impact of the increase in banks' funding costs, it's important to remember that the Reserve Bank Board is conscious of the various rates at which credit is being repriced when it sets monetary policy. So while there's been an overall rise in the funding cost structure for banks, the Board is able to set its cash rate target to appropriately take into account the effect on lending rates. So in the current environment, there is ample scope to lower the cash rate sufficiently to bring those other rates to where they need to be to achieve the overall stance of monetary policy that the Board wants to achieve. So in that regard, and this is certainly not true elsewhere in the world, it's important to stress that transmission of monetary policy still is very effective in Australia. Not only do lending rates respond to changes in the Board's cash rate target, there is no sense in which the aggregate supply of credit appears to have been constrained by changes in banks' funding patterns because of regulatory pressures. Finally, it's been suggested that while the regulations may not have a large impact on the supply of credit in the current environment, where credit's not growing that fast, a number of commentators or banks themselves have put forward the proposition that banks may have difficulty funding an increased demand for credit when conditions start to improve. I think that concern is misplaced. In an environment where the demand for credit has picked up because the world is a better place, funding conditions for banks are also likely to be much easier. Moreover, from a macro perspective, I really can't see how there's going to be a funding problem for the system as a whole when the world is a much happier place than it is today, even if an individual institution itself is not 100% sure where the next funding dollar is coming from. So to conclude, there have been a number of significant changes to the structure of financial markets over the past 5 years in terms of pricing and in terms of the composition of funding and lending. Regulatory reforms have certainly played a role in those changes, but one of the main points I want to leave you with today is that regulatory reforms have generally only served to reinforce the changes resulting from a self-reassessment by the banks themselves or the changes resulting from market pressures. While all these forces have been working in the same direction in the current environment, the regulatory reforms aim to ensure that these changes to a more stable financial structure endure once the environment is less conducive to self-discipline and once the market pressures that we see out there at the moment start to abate. So let me leave it there. Thanks very much, and hope you enjoy your lunch.
Thanks very much. We've just had a downgrade in our state credit rating by Moody's to AA+. Can the panel talk about what the implication of that is for our state and the branding issues around that and how that might relate to other jurisdictions?
Maybe I have a go at that one. And by way of disclosure, I'm on the advisor to the Australian Economic Development Board, so I better so maybe that biases my answer, but anyhow. So at the moment, South Australia is borrowing about as cheaply as it borrowed any time. In fact, it is borrowing as cheaply as it's borrowed any time in the state's history. So that's something you should bear in mind when you read about the rating agencies downgrading this state. Also bear in mind the rating agencies have some metrics that they like to look at. It's not exactly for a state, it's not exactly the same way that you would, if you're looking at a bank or another institution, you wouldn't necessarily use the same metric. I mean, I think that said, you know, there obviously needs to be a fiscal framework in place, but there are also, you know, needs that the government needs to be spending, particularly, you know, around infrastructure and the like. So yes, it sends some sort of message about the ratings downgrade, but in the end, what really matters is how much it costs you to borrow, and the state of borrowing, as I said, roughly, basically as low as it's ever borrowed in history. So you can take from that what you think the market's assessment is of the rating agencies' actions.
I suppose this follow-up question, Guy and also Neil, the semi-governments or governments like South Australia, how do they fit in terms of liquidity issues facing the banks? As you've shown there, most of the Commonwealth government stuff is now held overseas, not in particular Brussels. Where does it fit in terms of this liquidity issue?
under APRA's rules, we've said that state debt counts as a level one asset, so effectively the same as Commonwealth debt for the purpose of the liquidity coverage ratio.
And so that I showed earlier that 75%, about three quarters of Commonwealth debt was held offshore. For the states, it's less. It's about 40%. That varies state by state. And so a reasonable chunk of the rest is actually held by is held by the banking system. So because of the shortage of level one assets under the liquidity standard in Australia, as I said, most of the banks aren't holding Commonwealth paper, but they are holding a reasonably sizable share of state debt.
Now, going back to the old savings bank regimes, of 40% of their deposits held by state government debt?
Not that number, but the regime's not a long, long way away from that, I suppose.
My name's Tony. I just got a question for the panel. With the mining having in this state and having reached its peak, right, and it's probably going to go down for the next couple of years, with retail perfect, property market is down probably 20 to 25%. Manufacturing hasn't been around for a long while in this state. Where do you see the actual interest rates going in the next 12 to 24 months?
Well, that is a question I cannot answer.
Don't answer that.
No, you can answer.
I'll pass.
Neil?
We expect our assessment is that the Australian economy, forecast we published a couple of months ago, is for the country as a whole that growth is going to be somewhere around about trend. And yes, there are those factors that you talked about. We had expected the mining boom to peak sometime in the next 12 to 18 months. It looks like that's happening. It's not happening a long way different from what we expected to have happened. So, as I said, our assessment is that the economy is going to grow in aggregate, not South Australia necessarily, but it's going to grow somewhere around about its changing pace. But there are a number of risks out there, and some of them exactly relate to the ones that you just mentioned.
Peter Owen, Hassell Group. I'd like our panel's opinion on rating agencies, friend or foe. Do they add clarity, or do they just create a market for themselves?
Not saying what I said previously, but they're there. If you think about, or maybe they would call Dom out of it, Dom more business, but someone has to do the due diligence on these things, and it can be a rating agency, it can be an equities firm, and I suppose it's like the old saying, if they didn't, they weren't around, someone would, you'd have to create them. So, they do serve a purpose in providing information that investors can use, but then investors need to be aware of where that information is coming from, I suppose. Particularly in terms of looking at a bank balance sheet or the like, which can be fairly complicated to look at. Equity houses provide another source of information on that, but if you look at the rating agencies as being akin to that, I think.
Today, the rating agencies are putting out a rating opinion, with a heavy emphasis on the second word. They publish a methodology, and if you like, they turn the handle, and they follow their process, and that drives a rating. The investor should never abrogate their responsibility in understanding the security in question. So the rating agencies do serve a purpose in at least being able to apply a similar methodology across a very wide range of securities. So if you have a look at S&P and Moody's, they typically rate hundreds of thousands of different securities right across the globe, typically using a similar methodology. And for a fixed income investor, that can be a useful piece of information, but that doesn't abrogate the responsibility of the user to actually understand what they're looking at.
I completely agree with what Dom just said, but the other thing to look at is, there's a lot of heat and light around rating agencies, particularly regarding sovereigns. And I mean, to some extent, if you think about the information which is out there on sovereigns, there's a lot of it out there. It's fairly easy for your average investor to process. As Dom said, though, if you think about the vast range of securities, and actually, if you look at the ratings performance on debt securities, the asset-backed securities, complete disaster. Regular debt securities, actually, the rating and corporate ratings more generally, they have proven to be, you know, the track record over the last 5 years has been fine. So there's been some obvious areas, I suppose, of failure, but then there are other areas where there is clearly failure.
Jeff Hayter, Property Advisory. Given the apparent shortage of AAA assets in the world, what's going to be the effect on the funding environment if Wayne Swan achieves his surplus and stops borrowing?
I mentioned South Australia's debt costs were the lowest they've been. Recently in the last couple of months. If you go back a couple of months ago, the Australian government was borrowing the lowest since Federation. So 2 and 10 years was borrowing at under 2.75%. Now some of that, you know, if you look at government, for those to put in context,
the US government, which has a little bit of debt, last time I checked, is also borrowing at the lowest rate in its existence. So, and it isn't obviously rated AAA by every rating agency. So, the point of that is that government bond yields are low in most jurisdictions, except obviously some ones in Europe, everywhere around the world at the moment. In fact, yields on most stuff, if you look at the levels, are as low as they've been in history pretty much.
Chris Kennedy from William Bark. I wonder if you could tell me your opinion internationally of bank vulnerability. Are there any areas that you think future shocks in banks could emanate from?
Yeah, I mean, the point I think that Dom made earlier during his presentation in Europe in particular is that sort of the fact that the banking system and the sovereign are completely intertwined, and the problems that that's causing now. What's happened over the last month has gone some way to address that. The question is still there as to whether that's going to be effective enough because of a lot of the pressures that that Dom was just talking about.
Rick Carney from Business SA. I have two questions. The first one is, where do you expect the cash rate to be by the end of this year? And the second question I asked is in the context you are in South Australia, and that is, will the Crows win at semi-final?
So I'm glad I'm not a Port supporter.
It's only up from here.
Unfortunately, I'm a Carlton supporter, even though I come from Adelaide. So I'm in a worse situation than a Crows supporter. But I said I can't. I definitely can't say where the cash rate's going to be by the end of the year. The market thinks it's going to be lower. I said we put out. The board decided last week that where the cash rate, 2 weeks ago now, that where the cash rate was where it needed to be. But I can't. I'm just not in a position to comment on that. I said, but I am. I can opine on the football, and I'd have to say that I think that Adelaide's got a pretty tough ask against Hawthorn on the weekend.
Okay, I'll just ask one last question. Given what we've heard about the liquidity issues, the changes to capital, the way the Australian banks seem to be placed, and it sort of relates, I suppose, to the questions that often come out of South Australia, in terms of the structural change that's occurring in the Australian economy, how would you be saying that, in fact, the liquidity issues, the capital issues, aren't going to constrain the banks in terms of their ability to react to that, to be making new loans? Is it actually more... Richard's here. Is this actually more about how the bank management themselves are reacting? And it's a sort of a... I think it's an issue in terms of, you know, where our growth is headed and the stability of that growth. Hmm.
So it's certainly APRA's view that there is nothing in Basel 3 and the timetable at which we're choosing to implement it, which will constrain the ability of banks to perform their primary function in the economy. There are some things in Basel 3, I didn't really talk on today, which will constrain banks from doing some of the things which, with the benefit of hindsight, we would all say were pretty dumb, and some banks would still like to do. So we're confident in the flexibility of the arrangement. And the other point I would make is that
regulatory arrangements don't sit in stone, and if they turned out not to be acting in the best interests of the economy, then we would change them. But we, as I say, we are confident that banks have the flexibility under this arrangement to perform their function.
I would completely reinforce what Neil just said, and I don't think the regulatory changes which are in place or in prospect are going to affect banks' willingness to lend. So if there's an issue around different sectors and whatever, that will be a decision which reflects the bank's own willingness to lend to particular sectors in the economy because of assessments about the viability of that sector. That will reflect the bank's own decision-making process. It won't be a function of the regulatory regime that they're operating in.